skin time. Two shots of whiskey, I'm taking what's mine. Yeah, what you're saying, it's what you do. Your time has come, boy, I'm gunning for you.
Hey there, kids, and welcome to get another Rootin' edition of One End Alive or Preferably Dead. We're up to episode 15, according to Vaughn. He's a counting savant. So, episode 15. How's it going, Vaughn?
I am doing well, Hoss. How are you?
Oh, just peachy keen.
Awesome.
And tonight, we've got a fabulous, it's the same old shit we do every month. We're going to talk about a book. We're going to talk about a movie.
Yep.
And anything we get to talk about before we talk about that?
No, not to my knowledge. No.
Oh, there was something I wanted to mention. Viggo Mortensen has a Western coming out that he wrote and directed, I believe.
Cool.
I was going to send you the trailer for it and it completely slipped my fucking mind. So I was going to talk about that, but we'll talk about it next month. Screw it.
Sure.
All right, so we'll just skip on ahead then to this month's book. And this month's book, Vaughn chose Dead Acre by Retzi Bruno and Jamie Castle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're kicking off. You're me to go? Or?
I can give you the, you'd go, because I can't. I read the book this morning, so it's it's fresh in my head. I just can't remember the characters' names or anything like that right in the top of my fucking brain. Should write this one down when I'm actually reading these things.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to start with one of my fucking rants.
So, mm-hmm. Okay, please.
And we might have to come up with a little bumper music for Steven's writer's rants.
Yeah, because it seems like every book we talk about on this show is Steven has a problem with, regardless what it is or how close of a friend he is with these people.
Well, I do not know these people, so we're in good shape there.
Like I'm a pal of yours, but fuck your book.
My rant is actually not a complaint this time about this book. So it's not a complaint about this book. All right. But here's the thing with writing in first person.
Sure.
When you're writing in first person, I have two fucking rules.
Okay.
And those rules are, I have to want to spend time with this person telling me the story.
Okay.
So for instance, the one book I did not finish that I started last year was this, some kind of Cthulhu 1920s thing. It was
okay.
And it starts off with this guy. He's like, well, this man came to me with his story, and he came to me and said, you're the greatest writer of this decade. So, and me being the greatest writer of this decade, I told him I didn't have time for his bullshit. And he said, but you're the greatest writer. And I was like, fuck, I already do not like you, Mr. Greatest writer in the fucking world. When you tell me a story,
God, man, that sounds rough.
Kiss my ass. All right. So immediately that is a huge turnoff. If I don't want to spend time with this person, if I'm not going to sit down and listen to this character tell me a story, then immediately I'm turned off.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, my second bitch is I expect it to sound like a person telling me a story.
Okay.
So, for instance, one of my big bit, Jim Butcher, the Dresden Files.
Sure. Okay.
When you listen to a Dresden Files book or read a Dresden Files book, it feels like you're sitting down and this dude's telling you a story about what happened. He's not pretending to be a writer. He's not pretending to be anything. He's just a dude telling you a story.
Yeah.
Same with Rick Gualtieri's Tome of Bill books. I really enjoyed those. Even though the guy's basically just a nerdy douchebag.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's this dude telling you a story and you believe it's him telling you a story. Whereas something like Annihilation. I mean, the movie was pretty good, but the book was supposed to be like the journals of this woman who had gone through these experiences over these horrifying experiences over the course of a week or so.
Yeah. Yeah.
It felt like she was at home writing a novel in her basement or whatever. It didn't feel like I'm reading the journal of somebody who has gone through these horrific events. If you read Edgar Allan Poe is a great example. You actually believe that, when you read The Telltale Heart, This is this guy going fucking slowly mad over the course of the story.
Yeah, you definitely actually
believe it. And same with Lovecraft in a lot of ways, because he, you know, went through his whole Poe pastiche period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, you actually believe that that's what's happening to these characters at the time. And so I can't stand it when it feels like someone pretending to tell you a story, but it is actually pretending to write a book. You know what sure. I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like Annihilation felt like somebody writing a novel about their experiences rather than somebody telling you a story about their experiences or writing temporaneous version of the story. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's my two big bitches.
Okay.
Which brings me to this book.
Okay.
This book felt absolutely authentic.
Sure.
In every respect. I absolutely bought that this is the character telling me the story. This is a character who had enough intriguing about him that I wanted to hear what the story was that he was going to tell.
Yeah, definitely.
And listening to the audiobook of this, which we got to give a shout out to Roger Clark, who is one of the voices, you know, from Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah, he really, 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 really made this book. Yeah, definitely.
He freaking nailed it. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic job. So the story itself is that's where my issues are going to come in this time. It really wasn't anything that was so, the last two books have been, like the first one was extremely imaginative. It was all over the place with tons and tons of ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one was a fairly simple story. It felt like I can't think of the character's name that J.R. Lansdale does. But it's a preacher who's like, you know, kind of on this wrath of God thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So it kind of felt like derivative of that in a way.
Sure. It reminded me of like Jonah Hex in a way.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, which I'm not against. I mean, you know, there's the little nitpicks I have for this is like, so the character is this he's not undead, but he's on a path to kind of repay a debt because God has decided to turn him into pretty much, as he keeps referring to himself, as the hand of God. And like, it's this whole kind of, you know, monsters and, you know, demons and stuff like that, which I really thought was fun but it's like you get very little of his backstory, like especially like his death. Like they kind of started off with the preamble explaining how he, you know, just as he dies, like what his last thing as a living was. And then we get a little bit of a backstory, a little bit more, but it seems like this is going to be an ongoing book series. So we're going to slowly expand the. And I like the fact that it is this kind of ultimately like a detective story. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. It felt like a Scooby-Doo deal.
Yeah. It was nice that we held off on like it just being like just constant gunfights or constant fighting or kind of, because it seems very kind of like something's going to happen at some point. And he holds off until the very last, like, two or three chapters to kind of let out the whole, like the two big fights you get at the very end of the book. It kind of leaves it more to, you know, just our main hero trying to figure out what caused, you know, why he's stuck in this stupid town. Because he can't, like, when he figures out something that's, you know, because he gets premonitions from a certain angel. Oh, I can't remember the name of the character. Why can't I think of it now? And it's like, you're like, okay, that's cool. Like I liked all the stuff that was going on in it. I was kind of like a little hesitant about our first battle, because I was like, oh, it's lycanthropes. I'm like, like if you're gonna do this whole thing about good and evil, I understand why would you use, you know, werewolves instead of just being full on, like, let's just use all fucking demons and monsters and shit like that. Mm-hmm. You gotta have something else going on in there. You can't just be like, all right, and then just feel, a lot of people would feel just like it's like a Spawn ripoff in a kind of a way. Because that whole character, that's about, you know, if you read any of those comics, that's what it is. Like, he's a hell spawn who doesn't want to do the work of hell. So hell is sending everyone they can to stop him. So it's like, I kind of like that. I like the fact that, you know, it's just a simple little story. Like, yeah, it's 10, 11 chapters. It was short, and it really kind of gets you to like, all right, what's the next book going to be like on this? It's like, you know, it doesn't throw everything out there, and like it just like it gives you enough to be like, all right, did you like this? Okay, wait another year or two for another book to come out, because that's how we're working these things on. So Yeah, yeah. It was.
And that's where the one thing I might kind of disagree with you on, because okay. I did like, because like when he does have the conversation with the angel, there's hints that, yeah, that the angel's name is just the title, I believe, and that there was like another Gabriel before Gabriel. And,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. so this angel was passed over for promotion, was kind of pissed off about it. And so sure. there's a pretty nice dynamic where he's kind of like, you know, being a smart ass to her and stuff. So that was fun. But at the same time, you know, at the ending that we get is kind of like comes full circle to the beginning. And it was like a little bit too much of a coincidence who the girl turned out to be. That kind of bothered me. But other than that, I mean, like you said, it's just a fun adventure detective story. And it's got werewolves, and you think the werewolves are the bad guys, but no, it turns out there's something else going on, and there's something else that's going on. Ends up with another big show. You end up with another big showdown. You know, one of the people, the real mastermind, is much more powerful than he's let on. Nobody knew that he had this power. So there's a lot of stuff going on for a simple story. It's just fun. I mean, and the way it is written. And like I said, the audiobook version, he totally sells it. They sell the story amazingly well. So I enjoyed the hell out of it. I think yeah. there is another one in this series that okay. I have. Cold as Hell, I think, is the next book in the series.
All right.
At least I assume it's the same series, because it's the same guy and it's got like a very similar cover, same character on the cover.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, James Crowley. So yeah, yes. Black Badge. So yeah, there is a sequel to this. You'll probably get around to it, I'm sure, because
yeah, at some point, yeah.
Yeah, because like I said, I think we both enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was good. I thought it was a good time. You know, it leaves you open to this whole, you know, in the action, like I said, the action in the book is, you know, it's contained. Like, it's, you know, maybe a chapter or two, he kind of rips it through, and it's like, it just really moves, and that's what I liked about it. And the fact, you know, the resolution of the, you know, of who the bad guy is and everything like that, it's not like it's like, oh my fucking, like, you know, you're stuck in this small little podunk town, and this cobbler goes missing, who is pretty much the son of the richest man in town. This is pretty much a little bit of the, and he doesn't, you know, the great thing about this character, he comes to places, he doesn't know why he's there, and he gets meet with this angel, and this angel says, okay, figure it out. Like, mm-hmm. And he's pretty much stuck until he figures it out, like, and he feels obligated that he has to, whatever it is, he has to figure it out. And which it seems like the one thing that has happened in this town is this cobbler's gone missing, and his wife, who's this very beautiful Latin woman, who seems to have, like, you know, pretty much a lot of people in the town transfixed by her, is like, he's like, well, you know, I'll take on the job, you know. And, you know, you meet certain peoples, but it's like, it leaves you very kind of not cold. Like, there's no red herrings in this book, which I actually kind of liked. And the one thing that would be considered a red herring turns into something even more devilish than it should be. But it kind of, it created a world and kind of kept you in that world the whole time. Not I read it anyway, which is kind of nice, because that's the one thing I realized with some of these books that we've done so far, is that I'll read like a couple of chapters and I have to kind of go back and reread those chapters, because I'm like, I'm not really feeling this. But then once I read it again, I'm like, okay, I get where he's going, I get where he's coming from, and I continue on, especially mm-hmm. those first couple of chapters. Sometimes it just doesn't get me, like, completely hooks me. With this book, it just hooked me. And I just was able to go through the whole thing in one big shot. And I was like, all right, cool. I didn't even have like a, because we were also reading this for an audiobook, but it was, you know, like, audiobooks are the same way. If I don't feel it in the first, you know, two or three chapters on a book, I kind of put it down for a little while, and then I'll come back to it. But this thing kind of just really hooked me, and I was able to sit there and listen to the whole thing without any problems. And I think it is, like you were saying, I think I do agree with the fact that if there was somebody else reading, you know, doing the reading, I think I'd probably, because he puts a lot into the voice of the character.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And even the small bits of other characters that he puts in there, he does a little bit of a twinge on his voice where it just kind of, you know, just works out. But when you have the Crowley character full on, he's the whole, you know, you follow behind him the whole time. And he just does a fucking fantastic, you know, job of kind of getting that voice in your head and like, all right, I can picture this character. And I don't think I saw the cover of the book today when I looked it up. I was like, oh, it's like, that does not look like the character I was thinking of. But mm-hmm. I was like, but okay, I can kind of see where they're coming from. But yeah.
Illustration on the cover that mm-hmm. or both these covers.
Yeah.
And the guy looks a little more scraggly mm-hmm. than maybe you'd expect because one of the things, big things in the first part of the book is that everybody's confusing him for a lawman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you think maybe a little more clean cut, I think, is the
sure
image I had.
Yeah. But then when you like, they tell you what he looked like, the fact that like when they, like by the end of it, you're like, ugh. But like, cause he's been through, you know, at least this seems like it's his first like story that he's telling, but it seems like he has come across a couple of people before this.
Yeah.
He's and there's that whole scene when he takes his clothes off the first time and you're kind of, he's examining the, you know, he's telling you about the holes in his shoulders and his body. I love the fact that he's dead, but not dead. You know what I mean? Like he can't take any pain. He can't enjoy anything anymore. Like he can't drink. He can drink, but it doesn't really bring him any joy like it used to when he was alive. You know, and like there's a whole scene with the werewolves where he gets beat the shit up, and you're like, you're amazed that he actually is able to survive that, the whole thing. It does feel a little cliche near the end of that fight when the Indians show up like to help him out, like at the very end of it.
Yeah.
But it's like, but I'm like, he would have been like, there's no, like, I'm looking at him like, there's another like 45 minutes on this read. I'm like, there's no way in hell they're going to kill him off right now. So it's right. Like, you know, and it kind of makes sense because they've been slowly killing off Indians throughout the whole time, just kind of as like fodder for food and whatnot. It's like, okay. So at yeah, some point, yeah, the Indians are going to, yeah, they're going to make their attempt to come back and, you know, get revenge.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I didn't quite understand, because one of the things with this character is if he touches a dead body,
yeah,
he can see how that person died.
Yeah, it gets like a moment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so I don't know how that one Indian's body ended up in the cave, because it kind of sounded like he died out in the field somewhere.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But you know, whatever, you know, yeah, he did a good job by using that moment. First off, mm-hmm. it sets up the scene right there, so he gets all the bones, so you know,
yeah,
that he needs to do the next part of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
But also it gives you that kind of foreshadowing. Okay, the Indians are going to be pissed at them because, you know, they have been killing, these werewolves have been killing them.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was a nice bit of foreshadowing, at the same time advance the plot for what this character needed to do at the moment, which was get hold of his leg bone or whatever. And
yeah.
So yeah, I mean it was, and again, it's very, very tight, efficient storytelling.
Yeah, it was nice to kind of read a book where it doesn't feel like they're trying to jam in as much as they can, because it feels like their first book or whatnot, which is, you kind of get that with like independent writers. They kind of throw everything at the wall to see what sticks, because mm-hmm. it's like, you never know if they're going to, you know, if they're making this independently, like you never know if they're going to just like, all right, this is, you know, I did it, fucking awesome, and then take forever to get that next book out. So it's like,
yeah, I'm not, anybody
I'm,
like
I'm that. Not saying anybody I know or anything like that, but yeah. But yeah, that's what I liked about it. I felt like it was nice and lean. It kind of did what it had to do and got out without driving people fucking insane.
So, yeah. And like I said, my only one complaint about it was the big coincidence that in the last chapter was like, oh, so this is who this girl is.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I could have done without that. But otherwise, I fucking thought it was a really enjoyable time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's Dead Acre by Rhett C. Bruno and Jamie Castle.
Yeah.
And let's see, I think I picked next month's book.
Yeah.
So, I was going to do one of the splatter westerns, but I changed my mind because one came out this past month or so called Red Rabbit. I want to take a look at. I should have pulled it up so I'd know who wrote it. But anyway, Red Rabbit is the book. All right. So, and then we do have a movie to talk about.
Yes, we do.
1971, mm-hmm. directed by Terrence Young, Red Sun.
Yeah.
Starring Charles Bronson, Toshiro Mifune, mm-hmm. Alain Delon, Ursula Andress, Capucine.
A weird fucking group of people in this film.
Yeah. And one guy we've talked about before, Guido Lollobrigida.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Anthony Dawson, which was an interesting choice.
Yeah.
So these are the main characters there. And of course, Guido, we talked about in God Said to Cain, he was in that.
Yes, he was.
And this is kind of interesting because you have one of the writers of this, William Roberts, wrote the screenplay for The Magnificent Seven, which of course starred Charles Bronson, and was a remake of The Seven Samurai, which starred Toshirô Mifune. So now you've got both of them in a movie together, written by the guy who wrote the remake, or at least helped one of the probably a dozen people that wrote the remake. He's the guy that ended up with screen credit. And you've got Ursula Andress, who had worked with Terrence Young before on Dr. No, and as did Anthony Dawson, and who later went on to play Blofeld in a couple of the Bond movies. The story of this one, Charles Bronson is a train robber by the name of Link Stewart. He and his partner Alain Delon, playing a character named Gauche, they rob this train where the Japanese ambassador is going to DC to deliver a gift from the emperor, a samurai sword. They hold up the train, and in the course of the robbery, Gauche decides to steal the samurai sword.
But not even
And
just a samurai sword. It's an ornate gold
yes, it's a
trimmed
very
samurai sword. It's
elaborate
yes.
samurai
You
sword.
understand why he's bringing this as a gift, right? He's left his country. He's come here in the rugged West to bring this samurai sword to this, and you're like, all right, cool. It's like, because when you see it, it's like, oh, I can understand why you would want to give this to someone first and also want to steal this fucking thing because it's fucking beautiful looking, you
Yeah, it
know?
is. Yes. So Gauche double crosses Link and tries to blow him up, but Link manages to escape. As Link recovers, the ambassador charges Link and Kuroda, played by Toshirô Mifune. He said, basically, you have 1 week to get the sword and get it back to me. Otherwise, we will be disgraced and we will cut your head off.
Yeah, and pretty
So
much
we'll.
he gives him the small he gives him a knotted a knot like a knotted rope attached to a dagger, which he's pretty much going to give himself Harry Carey if he doesn't get it in time when all the knots are gone. It's like, I guess it's according to how many weeks, and it's like, okay, cool. And you have Bronson, who what was it? He just did a film before this with him called Cold Sweat, same director, and that film is it's kind of typical Bronson of the time, but there's a goodness to that film. It's a nice little actioner, and him kind of coming into doing this, which it's clearly the thing with this film. It's like it's so strange because it's a it's a buddy cop kind of a film. These two kind of exact opposites being forced to work together, and I love the fact that the Mifune character is practically silent for the first 30 minutes of the film.
Oh yeah.
And Link and Bronson's character just even treats him like that, like he doesn't know English, and he continues to talk to him as he thinks he understands it. And then at one point he just speaks English and he's kind of shocked by this. He's like, wait, he's like, you speak English? He's like, yeah, you never asked. You just assumed that I was fucking that I didn't speak. Like, why would you think I'd be here if I didn't know how to speak English? It's like, and they become this kind of this odd couple that they have to tackle this whole thing. And it's like, what the it's so strange. It's a good film. I thought it was a good film for the most part. There are certain things I didn't particularly care for. The fact that Mifune's character kind of goes out like a bitch at the end of the film, which I was like, the whole gunfight at the ending. Like, I thought his character, I remember reading about this film and the fact that they're like, oh, Mifune's not used enough. He's not used enough. And I'm like, we watched the same film. I think they had equal parts, action towards each other and scenes. It's not like it was just the whole Charles Bronson fucking show and Mifune sitting in the back.
Right.
Like, it would.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're very different characters.
Yeah.
Bronson's kind of like the charmer, and he's for an outlaw, he's not like the sociopathic type. He's laid back and he likes to joke, and he's a pretty friendly guy overall. But he's also very driven, and he wants his gold back, and he wants to get revenge on Gauche. And the entire conflict between Bronson and Mifune is Buffoonie is going to kill him on sight and get his sword back. He doesn't give a shit about the gold.
Right.
And Bronson's like, well, no, look, I'll help you because you're going to cut my head off if I don't.
Yeah.
But just let me have a day to beat the shit out of him. And
yeah, I need to get the information for this. Yeah, it's like, yeah, because this way
we'll both win out. And
yeah, I spent all this fucking time getting his gold. I deserve my portion of it, or all of it, if we can kill off my ex-associate. And he's, because his job is about getting the sword back, regardless, if it causes his life or anyone else's life. That's the job. That's what he's been up to. And the whole thing with like the samurai and all that other stuff is, about loyalty and respect, and kind of when you're put on a task, you do that task at all ends. You know what I mean? So it's interesting. I don't, the whole juxtaposition of these Japanese men being on this train is kind of a weird thing. But I love about that kind of like speculative style fiction. It's like when we put something strange in the West, like a lord and his two Ronins with him, and the one that survives, because you have that whole fight where he kills off the other one who's a little more he's more steadfast, and he just pretty much gets annihilated real quick. And you have the more kind of older, astute, more sure of himself samurai who's put on the task to kind of get this sword back, which is like, okay, cool. And like, and this is Mifune, like in the 70s, a lot of people would consider him, past his prime, 50s, early 60s, stuff like that, the kind of stuff he was doing Kurosawa. But he continued to work after this. Like he didn't retire. He pretty much worked until he died. Most of these great actors, they always found work. They didn't continue to stop. And because he was a name, people were like, fuck yeah, let's keep hiring him. Like, so, and you have a youngish, I guess you can say, Bronson, kind of replaying his characters from the many Westerns he had made before this. But like, I kind of find I'm not a huge fan of Bronson, mostly because of all those Death Wish films in the 80s kind of really spoiled me, like really soured me on him, because it just kind of became, Gatling gun Bronson fucking killing down rapists,
there wasn't much to those characters in like the 70s or the later 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Whereas his stuff in the 60s and early 70s, there's a lot more variety to the roles he picked up. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of them were Westerns, it was still, he's much different character than what you ended up with.
Yeah. And like, in my generation has always kind of known him for those, like, Death Wish 5 and shit like that. And they all sit there and like, watch them and giggle at them. And I'm like, no, this guy's, got a great reputation before that, from the early 50s all the way up until the late 70s. Great, great body of films. But it's like they all want to sit there and cackle at the stupid shit that those old canon films were. And it's like, yeah, just, maybe dig a little deeper. And I understand, like, the guy was like 105 when he was making those fucking movies. So it's like, it's just ridiculous to see him carrying these hand cannons, blowing people away. But it's like, you look at a film like this and you're like, oh, this is why you like this fucking guy. Because he's funny, and he's got this kind of mood to him. And he doesn't seem to take anybody's shit. And like, he slowly gets to know this guy that he's forced to work with, mainly because he wants his gold, but he's put on the task because your friend is the one who stole our shit. So if you don't come along and help us, we're going to kill you. Yeah. So he's like, all right, fine. There's a 50-50 chance there. Like he's going to, and you know, it's Bronson, because it's like, DeLon, which is, I love the fact that they make him the bad guy, because like, 10 years earlier, he was doing like stuff like Samurai and stuff like that, all these like French New Wave films. And then he's like, he's getting into American features, and he's like the daring dandy bad guy. And you're like, okay, cool. Like, it's such a weird, and that team up, the two of them, is like a weird juxtaposition too. It's like, it's a strange film, but I really enjoyed like every minute of it.
Well, but I don't think I'm quite as hot on it as you are.
Sure.
There was a lot that I did like. Like, for instance, the character Mifune, mm-hmm. at one point, because as I said, the whole dynamic is Bronson's trying to convince him to give him a day to get the information about the gold out of him before Mifune kills him.
Sure.
And I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be a big deal to him, but mm-hmm. it is, because you know, this is his only mission.
Yep.
And at one point he's going to drown Mifune, and Mifune is not going to relent. He is not going to relent. But then later on, and so after that scene, when Bronson's like, fine, whatever, Jesus, come on. And, but then they're talking and he's explaining, you know, how this way of life of his is being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's the Western influence in Japan now, and the samurai way is coming to an end. And, you know, it's, he's been a his father, his grandfather, his great grandfather, they were all samurais who fought in battles and died.
Yep.
And, you know, this means fucking everything to him. This mm-hmm. is his entire existence. And this is his, you know, he's trying to keep these traditions alive. And this is his chance to be a part of history, in, at least, you know, this tradition of his family. And then later on, now that Bronson knows this, later on, he like steals Mifune's clothes when they're out in the freaking freezing weather.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, okay, look, you know, you said this is your mission. You know, you're going to, which would you rather do, finish your mission or sit out here and die? And he kind of like, kind of uses, you know, that Mifune's mission against him in order to get him to give him what he wants.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it shows that Bronson has gained that understanding of how Mifune's brain works. And he's clever enough to use it against him, which I thought was a great character development. And these two characters work great together. I mean, you know, it's that whole, like you said, the whole odd couple thing.
Yeah.
You take, you know, two characters that one's very stoic and one's kind of a, you know, more freewheeling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let them play off of each other. And they do a pretty good job of it. And I wish there was more of that. That was the one thing I wish there was more
of.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the one time I laughed out loud was, Charles Bronson, he's like, oh, God, you're a hell of a guy. And Mifune says, yeah, and you're a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I was like, that's perfect. We need you know, more of that kind of
stuff. Yeah, it would have been great if there was more kind of this back and forth with them, too, because it's a lot of monologuing with Mifune in the film, because he just goes on these like soliloquies of like, yeah, like how the world he comes from is slowly changing on him. And he is like this dinosaur. And you know, and like of his, there's also like the fact that he's an aged samurai, you know, so he's kind of past his prime. So he feels that this test to kind of go and get the sword back is, you know, like I said, it's a test for him to kind of be able to do it.
Yeah.
I think like characters like Ursula Andress, I think Ursula Andress is completely like just, I don't know if we needed like a big actress for that character. Like Ursula Andress at his time was a huge star. And I just like you can just tell, like it feels like this guy who made a bunch of like Bond films and stuff like that prior to this, and he kind of working towards this. It feels like this is like the A picture where they're like, all right, we're gonna push it. We're gonna give you all these big actors, go forth, right? Because mm-hmm. it's you know, you have two great European, three great Europeans, so Ursula Andress and Mifune and Delon, right? You have these three great, you know, European actors. Who are kind of at the time at probably at the like, well, Mifune is like the heavy hitter out of all of them, but like the two others, Ursula Andress and Delon, are at pretty much at the top of their fucking game by like the, you know, mid.
Yeah, at least as far as in the European market, and of course, right?
And
the
and
Bond movies like, made Ursula Andress a
sure, and name. It's like, and like in this is like a transitionary film for Bronson, because it's much more of a comedic character, I guess you can say. He comes off as a guy who's very kind of like. Not like the typical kind of Bronson we had before this, where he's a fucking, you know, shirtless fucking, you know, man's man, kind of like, you know, grab you by the throat type of bullshit. And he's a character who's just kind of like, you know, like doesn't like he's taking it seriously, but he's like ultimately like, why do we have to fucking be so like, you know, like
just, why are you so uptight?
Yeah, it's so relaxed and like laid back, but he knows that the task is to get done with, but he's like. Let's just take it easy. Like, what the fuck? We got time. Like, just relax. Like, it's like, and it's like, okay. And you have that big gunfight at the end of the film, which I thought was funny in that kind of 70s way of like almost to the point of comedic how insane that gunfight is. It's like, okay, cool.
It was a pretty cool set piece. And this, that's, and there's this kind of disconnect though for me because you have this European director. They're basically doing a spaghetti Western, you know, it's financed from Italy and filmed in Spain. That looks like a spaghetti Western. But everything else about it is pure Hollywood Western.
Yeah, definitely.
This, it doesn't have that same, it looks like, you know, a spaghetti Western, you know, the scenery and all that. And it's a little bit dingy, but it, I mean, the, everything else about it, it's just pure Hollywood. And which, you know, I guess, you know, given the director that you have, you know, he's had me a mainstream success for a number of years at this point, for at least 5, 6, 7 years. So, you know, it did kind of felt like a little bit of a disconnect. And the score is very much the Hollywood with the Western with the strings, you know, it's, it almost sounds like the, Magnificent Seven, you know, you know, that kind of score with all the strings and the twangy guitars and shit that you get with the, you know, Morricone soundtrack. So it's a little bit of a disconnect. It was one of those things where I was, you know, you look at the cast, you look at the director, you look at the writers, you look at everybody that is involved in this, you think it would be just a little bit better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was, there was a couple things that just really kind of threw me out. And one of the things are especially the ending.
I was about to say that. The ending feels like it runs out of time.
And this is what pissed me off. And this is the huge spoiler of it.
Okay.
All right. So Bronson, so if you want to go check it out, it is on Tubi. It's free. I think it's on Amazon Prime. And
yes, YouTube, that's how I watched it. I watched it on Prime and it's on Tubi.
So at the end, you're down to Ghosh, Mifune, and Bronson. And Ursula Andress. Those are the four characters left. All the Indians are dead. The there's bodies all over the place, and the cane field they're hiding in is burning to the ground. And so Gaush and Bronson are facing off, and Bronson's out of bullets. So Mifune comes up, you know, comes out of the fields, out, you know, sneaks up behind Ghosh. And this is the dumbest thing in the fucking movie. Bronson yells, "Kill him." Well, he was going to. He had it under control. Which alerts Ghosh that Mifune's back there. He turns around and blows Mifune away.
Pissed me off. Like,
because I was like, he had it under control. But the whole thing was you have to get Mifune killed by Ghosh in order to set up the ending of the movie. But Bronson, it didn't have to be Bronson's fault. But the thing was, I know why they did it. Because what they wanted to do was show that even though Bronson said he wanted to keep Ghosh alive, you know, for the, in order to find out where the money was. When it came down to the, you know, the end of the day, he'd let Mifune kill him if that's what, you know, if that's what had to happen, that's what had to happen. So they're letting you know that Bronson has had this change of heart. But it also gets Mifune killed, which is bullshit.
It was just so sloppy.
Like, there had to be a better way of doing
it. It felt like they didn't have a real, a real understanding of how to finish this film. And they had to kill, off the Mifune character. They're not going to fucking kill Bronson off. When have you ever seen that? It's like a contract thing that Bronson, I think, had was like, you cannot kill me in any film at all. So it's like,
didn't he die in Magnificent Seven?
Once. When he was too young and didn't have control, but every other film, it's like, nope, you can't kill me. Regardless how stupid the film is, you can't kill me. And it's like, okay, cool. And it's just like I said, he goes out like a punk, and you're like, fuck, this is like Mifune. It's like,
Yeah, this is a guy who was like picking off Indians with like throwing knives.
Yeah, and it's like,
you know, from horseback and like picking up a bow and arrow, and
it's great. With, that whole sequence is
horse for, and like, then he gets, yeah, and then he gets riding with no hands,
and he just gets punked like at the end. You're like, fuck, come on, like, geez. And then, like, you know, he gives him that whole thing. He's like, well, I failed. Like, blah, blah, blah. He's like, no, don't worry, I'll figure it out. Like, and you're like, okay, yeah, great. Like,
no, you haven't failed, because I'm going to pick up the sword and I will
take it. Yeah, I'll get it. And then, yeah, and he doesn't even like, we don't even get like a, we don't even get a scene where like the character goes and actually hands it back. He like leaves it on the fucking, like, the wire.
Yeah,
like as a train. Yeah, and it's like, what the fuck? Like, really? That's how we're going to end this thing?
What if they don't even, yeah, what if they don't see it up there?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, because the samurai, he's standing there looking at the train platform.
Yeah.
Well, if he doesn't look up, then all of this was fucking nothing.
Yeah, it's like, you at least, like, you don't even have the character, like, even have any speech. You can have the character, you can have
let Bronson, you know, tell the ambassador about the sacrifice that Mifune made, so that, you know, this legend, that this,
yeah, his character can go off as a legend. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, because this legacy, so his legacy can live on, because that's what this whole journey for him was about, was his legacy.
Every soliloquy that Mifune gives on the film is about how, you know, it's about how the changing of his country, but it's also about how, like, you know, he doesn't want to fade away. He wants
exactly
that. And it's like, you wrote all of this about this character to give us this whole thing about how he wants to be a legend, he wants to be remembered, da, 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 da. And then he gets shot dead, and the ending just shows the fucking the sword up in a on a wire, and you're like, the fuck is that? You like, you guys run out of time, like, or like, yeah, like, and there's a handful of really great writers in this on this screenplay. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe they had too many hands in the fucking cookie jar for the writing.
And yeah, they all, I think there's like six or seven altogether.
Yeah, and there's a couple of guys, like the one guy who wrote Little Girl Lives on the Lane is one of the writers.
He wrote the original treatment for this.
Yeah, and it's like,
and he's the one that got Mifune to come on board. I mean,
and there's like, yeah, the six writers, and that's the one thing always boggles my mind when you see more than like two or three writers on a film, especially if you hear the history of the film. It's like, oh, you know, like, it was originally concept and written by this guy, but then it went to, you know, production, and they were like, oh, you need to change this and that. And as they started bringing people in, like, as actors, like, oh, I'm not doing this, oh, I'm not doing this, so they had to start changing fucking things around again. And it's like, fuck. And like, you get to that ending and you're like it would have been like a 5-star film for me if you actually got to that result. Like, even if he gets killed the way he gets killed, if, you know, you have Bronson's character at least explain to him, like, that he died in honor. He, yes, died valiantly,
exactly,
you know, trying to, you know, defending this sword, and, you know, in his dying words, he handed this me off to make sure it got to where it needed to go. Something, just fucking something. No, it's on a telephone wire. It's like, what the fuck? Yeah,
it was infuriating.
Yeah,
because it just throws away everything that all these characters, both these characters went through, the
right
transformation that happened in Bronson. You know, where he's not worried about, you know, getting caught or whatever, you know, because, yeah, you know, he could get hanged because, you know, he robbed the train originally and killed a bunch of people.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, you know, he's risking his own life, you know, coming back here to return the sword. Mm-hmm. And, but he's doing it because he made that promise, and, you know, he knows how much it meant to Mifune's character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then to just say,
maybe
I'm not so fond of, you know, I'm good. Flip a coin and decide whether or not
it's
the right thing. All the character development goes right out the fucking window.
It's like, what the fuck? Right. It's a good curio. It's a good curio of a film. You know what I mean? That's the thing.
Yeah. Like, I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah.
Now, would I watch it again? Maybe, you know, it's one of those like Saturday morning, nothing else.
Yeah. Like Sunday afternoon, something like that. Yeah. Nothing else is on. I'll put on Tubi and throw it on. Fine. Like, if I'm cooking dinner and it's playing in the background, yeah, fine. Like, okay, but I'm not going to keep my 100% attention on it again.
Yeah. It was, I mean, the things I enjoyed about it, I really enjoyed, and mm-hmm. I wish there was more of that. And the things I didn't like, it was a little slow in the beginning. It's almost 2 hours.
Yeah,
it's fucking and long too. This probably, they could have done the same kind of character development in, you know, maybe the first 20 minutes, and then gave us,
sure,
you know, get to the whorehouse after about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But you do have, I mean, a lot of that first act of this is like taken up by that train robbery. And it is a pretty spectacular, you know, set pieces. You've got the, you know, horse guys on the horseback, you know, coming after the train and blowing shit up and blowing holes in the side of the train and, you know, people falling off and all that shit. It's fun, you know, but it's that, but it's that Hollywood, you know, friggin' action scene, you know, from the 60s. And then it's got that same kind of big set piece ending. But you got a lot of, there's a lot of good stuff in there. And if they could have just trimmed it up and left the good stuff,
yeah,
and changed that ending to where, you know, Bronson does the right thing, then I think you would have a, you know, 5-star movie.
No, definitely. Mm-hmm.
But that's my opinion. And I think that's about all I have to say about
it. Yeah, I'm in agreement pretty much. I think we're both in agreement on that. It would have been a much better film if it was just, you know, handled a little better. You know, it's a good film regardless. It's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. It's just the mistakes, I feel, keep it from being great.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
that's that.
Mm-hmm. So it's my turn to pick.
It is.
Yeah. So I'm going to do a genre of Westerns that we don't have many of them. And we just got one, a parody film in the last year. From the same guys who gave us, why can't I think of it now? The fuck is it? Jeneil White and whatnot. The, what's that movie called? Fuck. Yeah. No. Okay. Anyway, we're gonna tackle Boss from 1975, the blaxploitation Western directed by Jack Arnold and written and starring Fred the Hammer Williamson. It goes under other titles, but we'll get into those titles when we
yes because show. We won't be yelling the N-word.
Yeah, you can watch this on Tubi if you want, and it's the uncut version. For many years there was, you know, problems with the release because people were just kind of scared about the title. But if you will find it on, and there is a Blu-ray and DVD out there, which I'm probably going to dig out my DVD to rewatch this. But yeah, the uncut, I checked it this morning to see if it was the uncut, because I remember a long time ago when I watched this on tape, and it's,
yeah, I think, you know, you talked about it on Mission
Picture Master. I talked on my show a long time ago, but I remember finding the film on tape and watching it and the title being half blurred out.
Like, oh really?
Yeah. And like, it just, and it, and every time this, because it's got this wonderful, great intro song, like any great blaxploitation film. And anytime the title would go, it would fucking have this weird bleep sound in the middle of the, like, what the fuck? It's like, So I'm happy that people have finally kind of, yes, it's problematic, but, you know, have kind of been able to get over that and kind of, and this is kind of a series of Fred Williamson films, but this is the one that's like its own out of the three that he did as for Westerns. So, yeah, so we'll tackle that. Yeah, it's a good time. It's a much shorter film than the last one we did. It's under 80 minutes, so even better.
Yeah, because we're actually about a week behind.
So I know.
We got to catch up because I had some few things come up this past month.
We've had a bunch. You've had a fun couple of weeks, and us, and I've just been a lazy fuck. I've been like, whatever you want to do it. So, yeah.
Yeah, Lisa was like, I guess there's a home show going on this weekend. So I was like, you're going to be gone all weekend? Great. Hey, Vaughn.
Let's do it tonight. Okay.
Let's do it now.
Yeah. Before I fucking lose my, before I lose my edge and fall fucking asleep, because I've been up for fucking 3 or 4 days. All right. Yeah. Go. All right.
All right. So there you have it. Next month, we'll be covering the novel Red Rabbit and the movie Boss N-Word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we can get Mike in on that one, because he loves to say that.
God. Oh, my Christ.
All right. So if there's anything you would like to contribute to the show, the email address is jafmpodcast@gmail.com. That's jafmpodcast@gmail.com. Or give us a call on the voicemail line, 304-769-9006. That's 304-769-9006. And until next month, happy trails, bitches. Oh.